Gary DePaul with Unleable Leadership. Welcome to episode 127, Scott Jeffrey Miller with Stories of Humility and Gratitude. Here's a shout out to listeners in Burlington, Vermont, Springville, Utah, Allen, Texas, and Fountain Hill, Pennsylvania. With that, let's get started. In our age of 1 to 2 year employment stints, you don't hear people being at a company for 10, 15 years. Well, for Scott, he's been with Franklin Covey for more than 25 years. He served there as a chief marketing officer and executive vice president of business development. But he currently is working as the senior advisor on thought leadership. He hosts the podcast On Leadership with Scott Miller, which is becoming the world's largest and fastest growing leadership podcast. He reaches more than 6 million people weekly. You might not know that Scott has a column in Inc., and he has articles well worth reading. Here's some titles. Overcome the Urgency Addiction to Become the Leader Your Team Needs. 5 Ways Leaders Can Make Tough Conversations Easier. There is only one acceptable way to apologize for missteps at work. And another one that's timely. Follow this 4-step approach to reconnect with the post-pandemic worker. Part 1. Perspective. A life with no arms or legs. One of the 7 leadership principles I frequently talk about is put others first. It's a simple idea, yet often it's difficult to practice. In this story, Scott shares something that can help put your life in perspective and get you moving in the right direction to be able to put other people first. Here's Scott with his story.
I've worked for the Franklin Covey Company for nearly 26 years, by most measures, the world's most influential leadership development firm, co-founded by the famed author, Dr. Stephen R. Covey, who of course wrote the incomparable book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, and another gentleman named Hiram Smith, who was the inventor of the Franklin Planner and the Franklin Planning Process, of which hundreds of millions of people have purchased or learned from. From Hiram Smith, I learned this incomparable idea around living life, not through the lens of I have to or I ought to, but rather I get to. I get to take out the garbage. I get to stop and gas up my car. I get to have a high courage conversation with a colleague about some of their blind spots. I get to do everything in life, those things that are burdensome or joyful. For me, it's been absolutely transformative in terms of a positive mental outlook and mindset to look at everything through the lens, not of I have to or I ought to, but rather I get to.
And I'm sure that's been something that you've shared with other people and modeled for that behavior of doing that as well.
Well, I'm trying. I wrote a recent book called Master Mentors, which is based on the podcast that I host, what is now the world's largest weekly leadership podcast. Hiram Smith and Nick Vujicic were some of the master mentors in this series. And so I've written about it. And really, it has transformed my gratitude, my level of wanting what I have and not what I don't, and seeing what perhaps might have been otherwise, you know, overly burdensome or not exactly fulfilling tasks or duties or jobs in life, be grateful that I'm able to do all of those. You see, Nick Vujicic is the number one mentor in my book. Famous author and speaker. He has no arms and no legs.
Oh, wow.
Nick was born with just a body. To learn from Nick about gratitude, a man with no limbs, Nick cannot take out the garbage. Nick cannot drink. Nick cannot eat alone. He can't bathe himself. He can't walk. To be able to do all of those things with your fingers in your hands, I get to rake the yard. It's a privilege, especially when you see it through the lens of my friend, Nick Vujicic.
When growing up in the States, it's so easy to take for granted all the things that we have. Even when we're in terrible straits, so to speak, and things seem dismal, we're so much better off than different people around the world. Having gratitude for even when we're in our worst, it's a blessing to have that attitude.
Indeed. It's ironic. I had lunch today with a famous author and executive born and raised in India, has a home there. And we were talking at lunch how nothing will cure you of your greed and selfishness like a trip to India to experience, as a Westerner, unfathomable desperation and tragedy from young boys and girls that are living in the streets at the ages of 3 and 4, unclothed and huddled up around fires. Literally 2 hours ago, I had this same conversation around what it's like from a Western point of view.
There's a responsibility for helping other people when you're trying to help them build character, become more mature mentally and morally, to give them this type of a perspective. So not only do they develop gratitude, but also it affects their behavior and how they think of their lives and what they have and what they don't have.
It's so true, isn't it? I mean, one of the greatest gifts we can give ourselves is perspective and appreciation for, again, all that we have as opposed to what we don't have. Nothing will cure you of your selfishness like sitting down with the famous author, Nick Vujicic, who again is the first mentor in my book, Master Mentors. When you look at his journey and how you can scratch your head and adjust your glasses and pick up a glass of water subconsciously when you're thirsty, Nick can't do any of these things. He's reliant on everyone, yet he has such a great attitude. He lives not in the past and actually not even so much in the present. He very much lives in the future around what will come and what could be. He's been a great inspiration for me. And, you know, as a white male executive in my 50s with an enormous amount of privilege, much of it earned, some of it given to me because of my race and my age and where I live and my parents, it's made me much more humble and appreciative for the immense blessings that I have in my life that oftentimes I've quite frankly taken for granted.
Part 2, Striking a Match at a Gas Station. In a previous episode, Ed Gash explained the difference between being nice to someone and being kind. Being nice is a way to avoid conflict while being pleasant. Being kind is saying the things that other people need to hear at the right time. In this story, Scott shares with us how someone showed leadership by being kind. Again, here's Scott.
When I was the general manager of Franklin Covey's business in the central region based out of Chicago for 6 years, the president of the division came in one day and he sat me down in my office. I didn't realize what was coming next. And I remember to this day, I was sitting in these sort of burgundy red chairs with leather coverings on them and gold rivets. And he looked at me and he said, "Scott, you're standing at a gas station and you're holding a match." This was, gosh, 17 years ago. I remember like it was yesterday.
Wow.
And he went on to share with me in private, but with courage and accuracy, the things that I was doing that was disappointing him. The fact of the matter is he had found me to be untrustworthy, that I was not holding confidences. I was kind of the town gossip. You know, he would share with me something on his mind about perhaps a position he was going to eliminate. And then, of course, I ran around like a high school kid and violated his confidence. The lesson to be learned, A, is, you know, don't be a gossip, right? And learn to hold confidences. But the real leadership lesson was that, you know, this gentleman, who was a very dear friend of mine, ended up being one of the three best men in my wedding a decade later, he was courageous enough to give me feedback on what were my blind spots. I knew I shouldn't be gossiping, but I thought, well, everybody does it and I won't get caught. And it was too salacious not to share, an excuse and excuse and excuse. But he had the courage and the wisdom, the love for me to have an intervention and to say, "Scott, listen, I mean, basically, if you keep doing this, you're out. But I love you enough and care about you enough to kind of protect you from yourself. You're standing at a gas station and you're holding a match." Now, when your boss tells you that, although it's a metaphor, you'd have to be dense not to understand you're on the edge. I really honor him for having the courage to talk straight, not beat around the bush, describe to me in great detail what were the things that I was doing that was jeopardizing not just my stature in the company, but my respect with him. It's a great leadership competency, isn't it? Is to provide people feedback on their blind spots, to move outside of your comfort zone and directly confront and discuss the undiscussables. Whether you are a courageous person or you're overly shy or retiring, whether you like conflict or you shy from conflict, whether you are diplomatic or not, you have to balance the courage and the diplomacy in giving people feedback, whether it's about their performance or their personality in the office, their personal hygiene, their inability to offer apologies or take responsibility, whatever it is. This is a gift, arguably the biggest gift you give to your team members as a leader.
I like the phrase, make the invisible visible. And I think I picked it up from David Marquet. When you just talked about that situation, two things came to mind that on both sides of your relationships, you each encountered the crucial moment for the president was recognizing that there's these blind spots that metaphorically you're standing at a gas station with a match. The crucial moment is, do I share this with the person or do I let the person continue until Scott, you are no longer with the company or doing something else? Then on the other side that he did share this with you, how you reacted? Are you defensive? Do you respond in a receptive way? Those are some crucial moments in our lives in which how we act is so important and can trigger a whole bunch of chain of behaviors that elevates us or not.
It's very true, isn't it? Being a great leader means that you make it safe to give people feedback about themselves and you make it safe for them to give you feedback as well. We could have a whole conversation, couldn't we, Gary, about self-awareness and how none of us are as self-aware as we think we are. I'll tell you, a great exercise for all of your listeners is to, you know, really look at building your own self-awareness. Go ask people, what's it like to work with me? What's it like to launch a product with me? What's it like to lead me? What's it like to be married to me? What was it like to be married to me? What's it like to live next to me or live with me or be a partner with me in a romantic relationship or in a business? It's probably the biggest area of growth for everybody I've ever met, including myself.
I like that phrase that you use. As a great leader, being able to make it safe to have these types of conversations. And that seems to be so crucial, using that word again, for people to be able to grow and be in a position to grow is allow vulnerability and openness.
And I think the way you do that as a leader is you have to be mindful of a couple of things. First is to always declare your intent. When you're giving someone feedback, always start the conversation with, hey, Gary, thanks for coming in today. Hey, first, I want to tell you what my intent is behind this next conversation. It is not to diminish you or to embarrass you or to compromise you. So if I like use the wrong words or if my inflection is wrong, please forgive me. I might need a do-over. My intent is to help you become more aware of perhaps are some of your blind spots. We all have them, and me included, that I think actually might be not only limiting you from growing your career here, a career that I can see being fantastic, but not only limiting your career, but might even result in you having your career ended if you don't get your arms around these. You get the point, right? It's to declare your intent, because if you don't share your intent, the other person is likely to ascribe one to you. Absent facts, people make stuff up about your agenda. When you're entering a high-stakes conversation, always declare your intent. Use that phrase, can I take a moment first to express or declare what my intent is so that you're not confused? We tend to judge other people by their technique. We want them to judge us by our intent. The second thing is, you know, I've learned a lot of my years, 30 years in the leadership business, and that is we often talk about the golden rule.
Oh, yeah.
Do unto others as we would have them do unto you. Treat others how you want to be treated. I say hogwash. Practice the platinum rule. Treat others how they want to be treated, because not everyone wants to be treated the same. Gary, I have no idea what it's really like to be on the receiving end of feedback from Scott Jeffrey Miller. I'm a fairly courageous person. I have a big personality. My voice is long and loud. I'm fairly ferocious. And so I have to be mindful of how would this other person best receive this feedback? Might it be on a Zoom call? Might it be walking in the parking lot with a cup of coffee? Might it be going on a jog? Might it be in a neutral space in the office? Be really thoughtful of how the other person could best situationally receive your feedback.
To practice the platinum rule, we have to inquire and learn how the other person would like to be treated and what's important for that person.
That's it. Amen. Home run. That requires you to care about your people. As a leader, whether you're formal or informally a leader, it requires you to recognize first that your number one job as a leader is to achieve results with and through other people. And let that sit for a moment. Achieving results with and through others is your top role as a leader. Once that becomes your default mindset, your paradigm, your belief system, then you begin to build capacity in others. You coach, you mentor, you care about them. You understand their fears, their passions, their joys, their dreams. You understand what their strengths and weaknesses are, what their areas of growth are. You really begin to love them appropriately. People don't quit leaders who love them. People quit bad bosses and corrupt cultures. But if someone knows and feels like you care about them because you've taken the time to understand what is their life like and what's going on outside the office and what's going on inside the workspace, virtual, hybrid, however, then you better understand what people's nuances are. I tell you, it's an exhausting role. It's why not everyone should be a leader of people. I've written 4 books on this topic about leadership and how not everyone should be a commercial airline pilot, not everyone should be an anesthesiologist, and not everyone should be a leader of people because it's exhausting. It's often unrewarding in the short term. It requires you to model all the behaviors you want to see in those that work for you, and that isn't for everyone.
With someone who is in a management role, a lot of people are there because they have exercised to a great extent their intellectual muscle. Yet the part that really affects the engagement and the desire to stay is your heart muscle. We tend to focus on the intellectual and the logic side of it while downplaying the part that makes us all human and that makes us people.
You know, I don't need to follow that up with anything. That was a beautiful statement. Well said.
Part 3, the relationship asset. Anthony Klotz, an associate professor of management at Texas A&M, coined the phrase, the great resignation. I'd like to add to that and coin the phrase, the great resentment. While there's a rise in voluntary resignations, there's still a lot of people that are staying at companies who don't want to be there, and they resent their situations and the people they're working with. Scott advises us on handling the situation. Here's Scott.
You know, in my 30 years, I've looked and I've been in leadership, looked at lots of leadership roles. I realized that, you know, right now and coming into 2022, recruiting and retaining talent is everything.
Yeah.
Not just recruiting, but retaining talent. You know, people are quitting in droves for different reasons. The more mature generation, their home prices have doubled, or their home values have doubled, their portfolios are on the rise, and they're saying, you know what, enough is enough. The pandemic taught me that I have different values than I did a couple of years ago, so I'm out. And then you've got the younger generation that says, I'm out. Where are you going? I don't know. What company are you joining? I'm not sure yet. Don't know. Might open an eBay store. Might become a consultant. I mean, the economy has given everyone options. So as a leader, you should be really thinking about how are you not just recruiting, but retaining your top talent, because you're asleep at the wheel if you don't think they're being recruited to join another company. And not just for more money. If you care about your people, you'll learn what motivates them, because not everybody is motivated by the same thing you are. I think secondly, the best book I've ever read, best leadership book I've ever read, is called Multipliers from Liz Wiseman.
Oh, yeah.
Liz is a dear friend of mine, and we know each other well, and she's endorsed my books.
And she's in your book.
And she's in several of my books, yes. Liz taught me that all of us are either multiplying or we are accidentally diminishing others. You aren't either a multiplier or you are a diminisher. You're doing both all the time. And as a leader, our job is to understand, when are we accidentally diminishing others, so we can kind of feel it and see it and own it to create more multiplying moments. Because a leader's job, to quote Liz, is not to be the genius, but rather the genius maker of others. And Liz lists out 9 different accidental diminishing tendencies: the idea fountain, the rescuer, the protector, the pace setter, the strategist, the perfectionist, the always on, and others. I think it's the best leadership book because I can relate to many of these. For years, I kind of thought, you know, my job was to be the smartest person in the room. My job as the chief marketing officer, which I was for a global firm for a decade, was to be the most creative and the most educated on all the technologies, and on and on and on. And I often, Gary, confused that the buck stops with me. That's for damn sure. But that doesn't mean that I had to be the smartest person in the room. There was a joke in the 45-person marketing division: best idea wins as long as it's Scott's. And that was very humbling for me. So it was Liz's book that I think really changed the way I saw my contribution to lift others up and to ignite their genius versus always it being my genius. I could talk for hours about leadership competencies. I'd mentioned leading difficult conversations, coaching people like they want to be coached. The biggest insight I've learned in my career, and I'll leave it at this, 25, 26 years now with the Franklin Covey Company. Dr. Stephen R. Covey, who passed about a decade ago, he wrote the book, as you know, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And as the chief marketing officer, I was always being called by the press wanting to interview me on his book. They would call The 7 Habits of Highly Efficient People.
Oh.
No, the book is The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. Yeah, whatever. No, sorry. Efficiency and effectiveness, let's start right here, are very different. One is not better or worse than the other, but this is a profound leadership competency, is to understand when to be efficient and when to be effective. I am a very efficient person. Offline, we talked about my productivity. I get up every morning at 4 o'clock and I write my ink column from 4 to 5, and I write my books from 5 to 6:30. I'm a dad from 6:30 to about 8:20. I'm a husband for about an hour. And then I am an entrepreneur and a leader and a speaker and a podcaster and a writer. And then it all kind of repeats in the afternoon. I'm a very efficient person. And like all things in life, Gary, when our strengths are overplayed, they become our weaknesses, because I tend to treat people like I treat raking the yard. Enough is enough. Fast is good. When we know for a fact that in relationships, which is probably what leadership all boils down to, is developing relationships. Remember, your organization's most valuable asset is not your people. That's a bunch of HR bunk. It is the relationships between your people that is your ultimate competitive advantage. So if you believe that relationships are your organization's, your team's, your division's most valuable asset, which I absolutely do, and no one will ever talk me out of that, not brand, not logo, not cash in the bank, not supply chain, not investors, it's your relationships between your people. If you believe that to be true, then you realize you cannot be efficient with people. You may only be effective. To quote Dr. Covey, fast is slow and slow is fast with respect to people. So I think for those of you listening that can relate to me at all in terms of your productivity, like to check things off and make lists and get things done, and you're very productive, be very mindful that when you are with others, whether it's virtually or in person, slow down, turn off your phone, close your laptop, take off your Apple Watch, whatever it is that might be leading to a natural distraction that all of us face in a world with unlimited choices, and recognize that this may be a chance for you to consciously, even mechanically, move out of your efficiency default style, and for a while with that person, become effective.
I'm going to take two of your points, your first two points, and tie them together. We were talking about how people are leaving in droves. And of course, you've heard the phrase that's been coined by that professor from Texas, the great resignation. But there's the other side of the coin, which is what I call the great resentment. And this ties into Liz Wiseman and Multipliers, where she talks about people who don't resign, but stay. They become, as she says in Multipliers, the living dead, or the walking dead is actually, I think, what she wrote. So you have people who are not giving 100%. They're just doing enough to stay around because they, whatever reason, they weren't triggered by the pandemic. I've talked to some EVPs recently that are really struggling with the walking dead.
And it's not going to end anytime soon. I think we're seeing the front side, especially as the pandemic is uncertain in terms of its ending. When they're not feeling like they're held hostage, you're going to see them continuously reassessing their values and decide how do they want to spend and invest and use their precious years and their one life.
My thanks to Scott Jeffrey Miller. If you'd like to learn more about Scott, go to the show notes. And if you have a question or comment, go to unlabeledleadership.com, click the message icon, and leave a voicemail message for up to 1 minute. I'd like to thank those who give to the show. Your donations makes a difference because this is an all-volunteer service. I'd like to thank you for listening. This is Gary DePaul. Until next time, lead on.